The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, I caught up with Lisa Walsh, whose daughter Kiva has a form of dwarfism. She told me how Kiva has grown 4 inches with the help of pioneering limb-lengthening surgery. When Kieran Baxter's brother Ronan suddenly disappeared in 2005, their family's world turned upside down. He talked to me about their desperate search to find him and to bring him home. Jackie Donoghue lost her daughter Ashley and her niece Olivia in the 2015 Berkeley balcony tragedy. She spoke to me about the incredible work she's been doing ever since to ensure this does not happen again. And Robbie Williams talked to me about festive favourites on the release of his new album, The Christmas Present, and what 2020 has in store. That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy it. Do you want to know a top tip to when you're trying to figure out what a teenager wants for Christmas? I mean, the kind of mid to later teens or early 20s, just from personal experience, is because they'll never know when you ask them, is if you go out shopping with them, whether it's to particularly to a chemist or a Penny's or a Dunn's type place, and they're kind of looking at things, shadow them with your phone. Shadow them. Don't make a big fuss of it. Don't embarrass them. Just shadow them. And when they alight on anything and go, oh, yeah, I must get that, or I like that, or I like that, follow it behind, take a picture of it and keep going. Take a picture. Keep top tip. Top. And you're welcome. Lisa Walsh, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan.
How are you today?
I'm laughing at your top tip because that's exactly what I was doing yesterday.
Are you just, isn't it brilliant?
Absolutely.
And absolutely. I mean, it just takes, and then I find myself looking at all these fuzzy, badly taken pictures because you want to be a bit discreet about it too. Sometimes.
Exactly. Well, I was writing them on my notes. I was like, what's he saying? I'll write that down in my notes.
Strikes,
so there you go.
Write it all down. Well, listen, we're obviously peas in a pod in that regard, which is good. I like that. Okay, we spoke last January. Just remind people.
Can you believe it?
No.
Oh, my goodness. I know. I was actually listening back last night just a bit. I was like, oh, my God, I actually sounded like an absolute wreck, I think, at the time. It was just so emotional. Basically, when I spoke to you, Ryan, we were going just to Kiva's first operation. First part of a 3-part operation, which ended in a 4-part operation.
And so, before we go to all of that, I suppose, by the way, incidentally, Lisa, you are within your rights to be nervous. You had a lot going on.
So I was unreal.
Yeah, don't be apologising about that. But Kiva was born with?
Achondroplasia.
Which is
everybody else is dwarfism.
Exactly. And you had this, I suppose it was a dilemma in some ways, but that you had had conversations with her about whether or not to go for the limb lengthening surgery, the stretching surgery. And remind us about the nature of the conversation. How old is Kiva?
Kiva at the time was 9, so she was 10 in July. So she started at 9, and basically it was just, as I say, the limb lengthening surgery, which was a huge, huge, I suppose, decision on all our parts.
Sure.
But the biggest person really was to do this was Kiva. So she made the decision.
And was she, at 9 years old, was she very headstrong about it, Lisa, or was she kind of asking a lot of questions? How would you characterise her interest in this?
It was an awful lot of questions, Ryan, I'll be honest. She was very much, I suppose, the journey would have started 2 years previous to that again. So we would have, as I say, we would have been constantly in and out of hospital with Kiva since she was born, you know, seeing bone specialists. That would be part of it. You'd have to go to an endocrinologist, all these kind of things. So we were in and out, so we were starting it, and we were just told about it. So then, I suppose, Kiva came of age where she went to school and she started noticing her differences. She started noticing that she wasn't quite like her friends and she wasn't able to reach things and do things like them. So then we started talking to her about it. Then we started saying there's a procedure there. And she, like I said, back in January, she went to meet the team in CAPA National Orthopaedic, and she said no straight away. So that was a no-no. On her path, that was 2 years previous to all of this. And then one day she just came into us and said, Mom and Dad, I don't want to be small anymore. And can we go and meet that man again? That was it.
Okay. That's a big decision and a big brave decision for a youngster to come in. But also there's a smartness to her definitiveness. Do you know, like she came in and said, let's do this.
Yeah, that was it. it was just because I suppose we had, she knew she had been at an appointment. She had heard and seen, and he, like I said, and in January he drew all over her. He left no stone unturned with her. He told her exactly where it was, you know, what her scars were going to be and how this was going to be hard. And so she had it in the back of her mind, I think. And then when that just, it was just one day, I just always remember her coming into our front room and saying it to us, "Mom and Dad, I just don't want to be small anymore."
Yeah.
And that was it.
And Lisa, I recall you telling me, because I was kind of going, I was like, at the detail of what had to happen. And so let's go through it a bit. I mean, the first surgery you had in January involved what exactly? With what did they have to do with
Kiva? So I suppose the first one really was, I suppose Kiva was the first that Conor Green would have done the precise nail, it's called. So it's a new procedure that he's brought here to Ireland. So he's gone to the States and done all this, and as people have had it done in the States. And he performed this on Kiva, so it's her thigh bone started. So the first part of the operation was your thigh bone, so where that's where the precise nail can go in, because your growth plates, we'd say, are stopped at your hips. So the reason then you have to have part two is because a frame has to go on the bottom, frames we call them now because we're more technical, right? Whereas I called them cages back in January. She would have got them through because the knee plate, that's still growing. So Kiva is still growing her natural growth. So she had to get that procedure then on the bottom, which is performed here in Ireland as well. So
did she have to have the legs fractured in a way too?
Yeah, so both fibia and tibia will be broken straight down the middle. And that's where then all this procedure happens, where the top part in the thigh bone is the magnetic system, which is the precise nail, and the bottom part would be the frames, where that is like a wrench, we'd say, like you get like a little spanner, where you turn it a millimetre every day, and the same on the top part is magnetic, where the big magnetic system goes down the top of your leg.
Now, I'm thinking of medieval Britain and the rack, and I'm thinking this sounds really sad, because I also see a book I'm reading at the moment, so it's completely fresh in my mind. It sounds painful. Tell me that modern medicine has moved on in such a way that Kiva bounced out of the procedures in a manner of speaking, saying, "No, I'm fine," or otherwise.
All right. I suppose to the listeners that are listening and people that, I suppose, contact me on a daily basis about this, and every single person, Ryan, will ask, "Lisa, is there pain with this?" I'm not going to lie and sit here and say, "Oh, God, there's no pain." The pain management, we'd say, when they're in the hospital getting this procedure done, is under control.
Of course.
And I have to say, Kiva came out of that hospital on paracetamol. That was it.
Really?
Absolutely. That's all we had to give Kiva was paracetamol. You're not allowed to give Norfin, so you have to, because that interferes with bone growth. So you have to basically give paracetamol. That's what she came home with, Ryan. Then we'd say the machine was going down. Everybody was asking me, "Is this hurting?" Because that was the first part. And I would say, "No, she can't even feel it." And she'll tell you herself she couldn't feel it. The second part, where the frames go on, is quite invasive. But it's not what people would think as in pain. Like, you can't feel it when they're turning. When they're lengthening it, they can't feel the pain or anything like that. The only pain that comes, Ryan, is the physiotherapy. You have to get the muscle to reach the bone. So the bone and the muscle have to keep going at the same rate. So that's where the pain comes in, as in, you can imagine when you pull a muscle, you feel, "Oh God, I have to stretch this," or "It's really sore." That's the pain, but it's under control with paracetamol. So that's basically, when the minute Kiva knew she had to do physio, we instantaneously gave, like 20 minutes previous, we gave her paracetamol, and that was it.
Okay. Now, what about the growth? I mean, you talk about the machine moving over the leg, increasing millimetre by millimetre 4 times a day. 7 minutes each time.
Yeah.
For about 50 days.
That's it. That was on the top part. Yeah.
Okay. And has Kiva grown in the process?
Like, we just can't believe, like, he wanted 5 inches, we'd say, but we ended up, because Kiva's kneecap was compromised. So we, on one leg was actually growing faster than the other. So we ended up on both, we'd say, fibia and tibia, so 2 and 2. So she got 4 inches. Altogether, 4 and a bit altogether.
I mean, I find that as a layman just extraordinary. I really do.
I know. Even when I saw this first, I will never forget, come, I think it was March or April, Kiva walked into our kitchen. She hobbled into the kitchen, as they say. And she stood up, and I'm like, "Sorry." I remember standing there, and my husband, we looked at each other. I started crying because of the first time that Kiva literally looked over at the counter. She was looking at us. I'm like, this is not happening. Right. And it actually did. So she was looking and she was able to go up to the cupboard. She was able to open the cupboard that, you know, reach it without us even having to know the way, stand over her and open that door. Yeah. She put her hand up. I think I cried for about the whole day, I think.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah, yeah. I can absolutely understand that because you had a life expectation in terms of what what Kiva may or may not be able to achieve with the height that she was given by, you know, by nature, whatever it was.
That's it, yeah.
And then, as you say, medicine intervenes and modern surgery says, no, we can fix these things now.
Yeah, it's a lifeline. It's like I'm saying to people that contact me on a daily basis, it's a lifeline we were given. It's not for everyone, Ryan. I know that. It's not a case of, we're going to get this done. It's a really, really huge decision on a family because it affects everybody. And we had to consider Kiva and her mental state of mind and everything. But it's when you keep saying to her, and we had to keep saying as a family, this is going to be all worth it. And my God, it has been worth it.
Let me ask you a little bit about that, because you seem to be kind of suggesting a little bit, Lisa, that, you know, some people mightn't approve of it, is it? Or is it that
it's not for everybody. It's not for everybody.
Tell me about that.
I feel it's just not for everybody, as in some people, I mean, with achondroplasia, you know, they embrace having achondroplasia, and that's great. And that's their journey, and that's what, you know, but we just knew as a family, I knew by Kiva, the way she was speaking, I knew by me, I suppose, watching Anna's, her mother, and her, and her parents, we were watching her everyday struggle. We were saying, you know, we always say to her, Kiva, you know, love yourself first and embrace what you have, embrace achondroplasia. And she always says that, Mommy, I'm always going to have achondroplasia. And that's what we kept saying to her, this is what you have. But it was just the fact of we could see the daily struggles that this life and this world isn't built for people with achondroplasia, because it's not. I mean, it's out of reach.
And is it the case, do you think, that it's out of reach physically?
And
I suppose emotionally in some ways?
It can be.
And is it the case that sometimes people might say, well, maybe it's time for the world to fix itself to mind us rather than medicine to do the job? Do you know what I mean? Should we be acclimatizing to the world?
That's what I'm saying. We have to be kind in this world as well. But I mean, there is badness in the world. Ryan, you know that yourself. People aren't kind, and people can be quite cruel. Mm-hmm. And then that's a case of then, like, your own self-esteem has to kind of big that up and get over it. And that's what we say to Kiva on a daily basis. You know, if somebody says something, you have to get over it, Kiva. You know, it's nothing on you. It's just themselves. It's them as a person. It's not, you know, it's not nice. But we just felt the world isn't catching up, Ryan, with things that are out of reach, like ATM, you know, like the standard things like ATM, bars, restaurants, like public toilets.
Kind of everything, really.
Everything me and you take for, like, that we go around our daily business.
Yeah.
We can get around. Kiva, I always felt like, you know, she's always going to have somebody by her side. She's always going to have somebody with her. And, you know, everyone wants independence, Ryan, at the end of the day. We all need an independent life as well. And I always said I never wanted to leave this world. And knowing that Kiva could never be that independent, you know, in her own right, to be able to do everything that me and her dad and her brothers and everybody else can do. So it was really and truly, as I say, and I'm not going to sit here and lie, people would say, you know, oh, you're changing her, or why are you doing that to her? But it's not changing her. I always say it's enabling somebody. And when somebody gives you that lifeline in modern medicine, and it has come on so much, and I keep saying that to people, please don't think of it like it was a very long time ago. It was a completely different procedure back then, Ryan. It really was.
It was interesting to hear what you say about peace of mind, that if you were to die or disappear or whatever, that you feel that you'd be able to rest a little easier knowing that Kiva has the few inches higher.
That's it. Yeah, that's amazing. As I say, like, you can function at 4'10". You know, I mean, if I know by when Kiva gets to 16, again, this is just part one of the operation. She's got another two to go yet. And I'm saying if by then she decides, okay, you know, Mom, I'm okay now, I can do this, then I know as a parent, my job has been done. I know as a parent that I gave everything to my kid. There was no stone unturned. We told her everything about her condition. We told her everything that was there and that she was given this.
She's 10 now, is that right?
10, yeah.
Kiva, I should say. And she went into this operation and these series of operations at what height?
She was roughly around, was it 102? I could be wrong, 3 centimetres.
What's that in old money?
Oh, God, Ryan, I honestly
it's about
don't...
3'5", I think. Is it about that?
Not even. I'd say, oh, God, not even.
Less.
She was the average height of a four-year-old.
Okay, and now?
Well, I would say now she looks like maybe a 6-7-year-old, that kind of way she looks like. And I don't know in centimetres because they haven't actually measured her full length yet, so we'd have to...
About 103, I believe. And I suppose but a lot of children aged 10 can look 7. You mean,
yeah.
You know, a lot of children age 10 can look 13. You know, that's the nature.
Like, I don't think, like, looking at her now, and I kind of say, oh, you know, it's definitely made, like, I see a huge difference in her. Like, to us, it just looks, even with her clothes, the length that, you know, like, when I'm buying clothes now for her, I'm not buying 3 to 4, 4 to 5. I'm buying her clothes now that she can actually, like, 8 to 9. So she's delighted. Dresses are fitting her. Like, clothes are fitting her a lot different to what they were.
Is she there? Is she with you now?
She is indeed.
Do you think she'd say hello to me, or is she
shy?
I'd say
she will.
Yeah, I'd love to say hello to her.
She will, definitely.
I thought she might be at school. That's great.
Yeah, I'm good. I said I'd give her an hour off for
to talk to us. Oh, you're great. Oh, thanks for doing that. You're great.
Not
no,
a bother.
I'll
put her on. Yeah, I'll put a pop around now.
I have to write a note for a teacher now for school. It's late. Kiva, good morning.
Morning.
How are you today?
Good.
What's it like listening to your mum there talk about you like that? Weird?
Yeah.
Okay. Now tell me a bit about the operation. Why did you want to be taller?
Well, because, like, so I could get my own, like, cup of water. I could reach my own car door. I could, when I'm older, I can reach an ATM. And just do lots of things that other people can do.
And when you can you do all those things now that you've got the few inches? You can get your own water?
Yeah, I can.
And you can do the different things. And before that, before the operations, how would you describe life and doing little things like that?
It was just harder because I always needed someone with me, like going to a restaurant, toilet, and going just around places that I can't go, that I can go on my own now, but I couldn't back then.
Okay. And again, before the operations, did you have a problem with people saying things, mean things to you at all, or were you okay?
Some people always told me that I'm, like, they're taller than me, but that was just, like, I didn't really mind because I knew people were going to say that about me.
And did anyone stare at you and point and do things like that?
No one pointed, but lots of people stared.
Okay. And has that changed since you got a bit taller?
No.
So you still have... You know, people will always be peculiar. You know that anyway, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
And since... with all the operations, your mum was describing physio and that the real pain was that. What was the hardest part about going through all of this to get taller?
Physio?
Yeah, how come?
Probably the machine, I didn't like that.
Yeah.
And that's really it, to be honest. No, like, I couldn't walk.
Ah, so were you in a wheelchair?
Yes.
And how was that experience?
Boring.
Boring. And what did you do to stop being bored?
Well, I drawed. I went, like, my friends normally took me out. And I went on my iPad a lot.
Yeah, and just, well, that's typical and that's the right thing to do. And did you read at all? I mean, I always have to
ask. I did.
Who were you reading?
David Williams.
Demon Dentist?
Stuff
like
that.
Okay, you should read that one. Don't read that one. You mightn't like that. But he's great to read. So you were reading and minding yourself, and now you've got to go to school this morning.
Yeah.
What school are you in?
Carrignamar.
And who's your teacher there?
Yeah.
Who was your teacher?
Mr. Lucy.
Mr. what?
Mr. Lucy.
Would you tell Mr. Lucy I said sorry for keeping you late from school today?
Yeah.
Okay. Hopefully he won't mind too much. Put me back to your mum there, Kiva, and thanks and mind yourself. Nice talking to you.
Thank you, Ray.
All right, not at all. Lisa.
Yeah.
I'll just talk to your mum for just for a
Hello.
Moment. Well, Lisa, I mean, what an articulate young lady. And,
I know.
You know, and seems to be at one with this. Can I ask you the vulgar question? Was it very expensive, all of this?
Do you know, people would ask me that, right? Yeah. And I would have, I suppose I spoke to the team. I think everybody is different, do you know, so as in a ballpark, I suppose to give you a figure okay. off the top of my head, it is really expensive, but they obviously didn't tell us how much, but everybody is different, covered medically and things like that, so they really have to discuss with the team.
Yeah, that's a very fair answer,
Anne. Yeah.
But it is expensive, is really
it
what
is
you're
very
saying,
expensive.
Regardless
it
of your health coverage
yeah.
or whatever
yeah.
Pockets you might have, whatever ability to make that.
Yeah.
It's a discussion with the medical people and so on.
It is, because a lot of them as well, you see, Ryan, a lot of people will come from England, like you know, they're getting an awful lot of referrals about this, so every single case is completely and utterly, like, I suppose, individual to the person. So they'd have to really discuss it.
Gotcha. You are a totally different woman to the woman I interviewed 10 months ago. I can't believe it. You sound, I can hear it in your voice, can hear it in your demeanour.
Yeah.
You're just, your life has changed.
Absolutely. It's just, I think for the last month I've processed everything that happened.
Good.
And it's completely, definitely, it is a life-changing experience, both emotionally, both physically. It is definitely life-changing.
It sounds like a win for you, regardless of anyone else's thoughts on the matter.
Yeah.
As a family, privately between yourself and Kiva and the rest of the family, you think we win here.
You could get caught up in that, I won't lie, Ryan, you could get caught up in the he said, she said what
sure.
thing and what people think of it. And but I couldn't. I honestly, as a family, I have to say it was the best decision we've ever made. I feel like crying because it's so, it's like winning the lottery.
Well, that's as definitive an answer and analysis as you can possibly get. Have a lovely Christmas together, Lisa. It's lovely to talk to you.
You too, Ryan, and thanks so much.
Not
again to catch up, all right?
Nice
Mind
to catch
yourself.
Up with you. Yeah, we'll see you soon. All the best for
okay,
now.
Okay, bye now.
Bye
Bye-bye.
For now. 14 minutes to 10 o'clock this Monday morning. The text number 51551. You can email ryan@rte.ie. 51551 at 9:34 this Tuesday morning. I want to introduce you to Kieran Baxter. Kieran, pleasure to meet you, and thanks for coming in to see us.
Hi, Ryan. Thank
you. Your story caught our eye, and we really wanted to talk to you about it because there's a lot of kindness in your story, and there's a lot of decency and a lot of difficulty along the way. So what I'll do is we'll get down to business by talking about how this all began. I suppose ultimately we need to talk about 2005, and with that in mind, put into a bit of context Ronan, your brother, and your father, if that's okay.
Okay. Yeah, well, Ronan lived with my father all his life, really.
Sure.
And he suffered from depression, chronic depression,
yeah.
which complicated with schizophrenia. And I have to say, as a family, we knew this at an early stage,
yeah.
but it took us a number of years to actually come to terms with it, because it's a form of mental illness, and it's not something that you don't see that illness when you look at somebody at first
yeah.
sight. You
it's
know?
Not like a broken leg,
correct?
Where you see the
yeah.
plaster
yeah, yeah.
case
yeah,
on the
yeah.
leg, whatever.
Yeah.
So it's hard for people to understand it.
And we did come to terms with it. We eventually understood it after a number of years. And come 2005, it was decided that. Ronan's medical consultant that he would go on a new medication, medication called at the time clozapine, and normally for this he would be admitted into the local hospital and kept in hospital for a long number of weeks on to make sure that there was no reaction. In this case, Ronan was released very soon after starting into the medication. And we as a family, we weren't comfortable. My dad at the time was particularly uncomfortable with that situation. And it was agreed as a compromise that Ronan would be on. We lived very close to the hospital, by the way, in Cork.
Sure.
So Ronan would go on day release from the hospital. He'd stay overnight and he'd be released every day. And this particular Saturday, 13th of August, I'll always remember it. He literally got up. He was at home with my father. Walked out the front door. My father heard the front door closing. Bang. 5 minutes later, my father got up to check, where's Ronan? He
God.
Vanished into thin air.
Now, this story, and I would urge listeners to stay with us, because this story has twists and turns, the likes of which you probably won't believe. But it is one of those stories that if I was listening to the radio now, I'd say,
this is going to be desperate. And I don't understand why, but let's not reveal everything, because I want to kind of get to the point of when somebody in your family who's not well goes missing, and your mother sadly had passed away before, so your father was on his own.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Where do you begin as a family? What do you start to do before the panic sets in?
Well, I have to say, the initial reaction, Ronan, when he walked out the front door that day, he was 39 years of age,
sure.
He was an adult.
Yeah.
So the immediate reaction is, look, he's going to come back. He's only gone to Dublin for a weekend. He had a bus pass. He didn't have a passport. So our immediate reaction, Ryan, was, look, he'll be back. He'll be back. He'll be back after the weekend. Come the end of the weekend, he didn't come back. He didn't come home. Then the panic, the alarm bell started to set in. But we kept telling ourselves,
he'll be back.
He'll come home. And by the end of the first week, we realised we had a serious problem then. He wasn't coming home.
And that's when you start printing off posters and you get family and friends going to parks. Is that what you did? You did all the obvious things, important things to do.
By the middle of the first week, we had posters printed. By the end of the first week, we were putting posters up all over the city in our own locality. We were making phone calls to Dublin, all the hotels in Dublin, all the hostels in Dublin, anywhere and everywhere that we could think of, and nothing. We were just drawing a blank everywhere we went. And by the time we got to the second week, we knew we had a real, real problem.
You were in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, you had an old pal from college who was a detective superintendent by the name of Tony Quilter.
Yeah, he was fabulous.
And
fabulous.
This is when I think this is so important, this story, because this is the kindness of relative strangers.
Yeah.
So what did Tony do to help?
Well, he gave us all the guidance, the advice, and he was a rock in all of this.
Great.
And he literally, by the end of the second week, we'd phoned him at the start of the second week, and by the end of the second week, he phoned me and he said, "Listen, I want to come out and talk to yourself and your dad." And we met in the kitchen table at home in Bishopstone, Cork, and he said, "Look," he said, "there's no trace of Ronan." We had done all the CCTV, the CCTV of the particular train stations, the bus stations. We even had looked at the CCTV for Cork Airport, even though Ronan hadn't a passport.
Bank account.
He had a bank account, and he had taken his bank book, which had about €1,000.
And had there been any comings and goings from that?
Okay. I checked all that.
That's the obvious place, yeah.
By the end of the second week, Ryan, Tony had said to us, look, he said, Kieran, and to my father, he said, look, you're going to have to go to the media. You're going to have to put this story out there if you want. There is absolutely no trace of him.
And this is something that, you know, we as consumers of media and as purveyors of it, in my case, always have to take into account is that you are like a private citizen, private family. You do not want to be in the public eye. You do not want to be. But yet you feel, A, you need to, and B, maybe people will help ultimately, like as per this conversation. Yeah. But go back to this. You have to go public about it. And now you're into the media zone, which is a big hurricane, a tsunami, really, for a private family.
Yeah, yeah. After all, it was horrendous, to be quite honest with you.
I believe that.
Because we were bringing our family story out into the public domain and said, look, here we are. There's nothing we can do about this. We need your help. It was an appeal for help, to be honest with you. Just an appeal for help to try and just find out what had happened to him.
I can't help thinking about the needle in the haystack, but that's because that's really what we're dealing with. At what point did somebody see, you know, almost like the shiny reflection possibly of a needle in that haystack? What was that from the public appeal?
Well, it came from the public appeal, yeah. The local newspaper, The Echo, ran a front page on a particular day, 2 weeks later. And wouldn't you know, there was a guy who had been, he had just back from holidays. He'd been on 2 weeks holidays. He had been in Cork Airport. And you'll always remember when you're going on holidays, the time you boarded a plane.
Of course.
And he rang the guards and he said, look, he said, I saw that guy who's on the paper. I saw him 2 weeks previously in Cork Airport in the departures lounge at 7:30 in the evening. And the guard said, sure, geez, he couldn't be there. There was the only flight at 7:30 was a flight to Lanzarote. There was a London flight earlier in the day, which we had looked at the CCTV for and showed nothing. So he said, no, he said, I can tell you, he said, exactly where he stood in the departures lounge. So obviously the guards went back and we went back, looked at the CCTV, and sure as heck, there he was.
So now we have a sighting.
Yeah.
Was he getting on the
London plane? We didn't know at the time, but the London flight had been delayed 4 hours and nobody told us.
Amazing. And he didn't need a passport because it was, right?
Well, he should have had a passport. He had a bus pass, but he still managed to get on the plane.
Was it a Ryanair flight?
No, it was an Aer Lingus flight. Yeah.
Interesting itself. Okay, well, that's for another day's work. But let's keep the search going because now you have a sighting. But all you know then is he may be in London.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So the haystack just got bigger.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So what happened? What do you when you hear, okay, he might be in London, where do you go? I'm just trying to...
Well, if I could just say, when we went to the media, at the end of the second week, it was like as if the floodgates opened. I think, you know, there's a stigma in this country and in all countries around mental health.
Okay.
And we had posted posters all over the city about Ronan. So lots of people knew our story. Lots of people knew we were looking for Ronan. But once it went out in the media as front page news, in actual fact, it was on RTE TV, the 6 o'clock news and the 1 o'clock news and the 9 o'clock news.
Right.
All of us, the floodgates opened and people came to us offering help. And so it was as if it was then okay to approach us and talk about it. Yeah,
that is nearly a whole other conversation about how you were nervous about bringing it up, the taboo, the stigma. That we are talking about 2005, I suppose, but still, the fact that once you do, people are much more open than you might think.
Absolutely.
So the fear is pretty much unwarranted. But let's keep going for a search, because now you have to go to London.
Yeah,
you went to London.
Yeah,
where do you begin?
Well, a good friend of ours had known a guy called Dermot Keating, who had worked. He was, believe it or not, originally from Ireland, and from Kerry. And I had never met Dermot, didn't know about him, but he had worked his way up through Scotland Yard in London.
Oh, I love this.
So I got his number, and we made a phone call to Dermot, and that was the starting point. Along with, I made a phone call to the Press Association. Here in Ireland, and basically said, lads, I need contacts in London for the London media, because that was going to be the key again to try and get in and break the London media and break Ronan's story into the London media.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there we started, and we for a few days we did all the work before my, and then ultimately at the end of the third week, so we were 3 weeks.
3 weeks late. Wandering around.
No, 3 weeks late, arriving in London. Ronan had been there 2 weeks at this stage.
Gotcha.
We had another week preparing, getting ready, making sure that we had all the ducks in a row for London. There was no point just landing in London unorganised.
Well done.
So Martin, my older brother, myself, landed in London the Saturday of the third week, and that's where we got stuck in. But it was just... as you say, needle in a haystack stuff, it was enormous.
Amazing.
The problem.
Now, you get to London with your brother, and I suppose you went to as many police stations as you could. You had to tap the media there. You've got Scotland Yard, thousands of people in their database of missing persons unit.
Yeah.
I'd say your eyes were open like they'd never been before.
Yeah.
And yet, we need to get to the point where, I think it was the Irish Post carried a photo, is that right? This was really important.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm loving the connection of the Irish domino falling, whether it was with Dermot Keating in Scotland Yard, or now we're into the Irish Post. So tell me about the importance of the Irish Post.
I got a number for a reporter called Anne Diamond, who worked with the Irish Post.
Yeah.
And the Irish Post is one of the most read papers in London, and it is the paper read by the Irish community, I understand, in London.
Absolutely.
It's all about Irish news. So Anne met us, she brought a photographer, and she agreed to do a front page article on the Irish Post a few days later. And so she put this out on the Irish Post a few days later, and that was
critical to your story. Should also add, Ray Walker, for example, press attaché in the Irish Embassy, helping out. You had the juries, Kensington. saying we'll give you a rate on the room.
Absolutely.
As long as you're searching. I just like these little touchstones of decency along the way. But let's go back to the photograph. Anne Diamond's article, front page, Irish Post. You're now 31 days into your search for your brother.
Yeah.
Where do we go now?
So we were doing all the usual things. We were going from police station. What amazed me was when we had spoken with Scotland Yard, the Missing Persons Bureau, they explained to us they just keep a log of missing persons. There's no connection with the local police stations. So we had been advised, look, there's maybe 10 central police stations in London. You need to go there. You need to log Ronan's details on with the sergeant in charge in each of those police stations to make sure that there's some connection back to the Missing Persons Bureau in London. So we did that.
Great.
And lo and behold, the Irish Post produced this front page article with a photograph. And there was a lady on a particular morning went down to the shop and she picked up, the newspaper. She was walking back. She saw a guy at the park trying to light a fire to keep himself warm. And she phoned the police, thank God, and the rest fell into, all the pieces of jigsaw fell into place.
It was Ronan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember the police calling you to say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What happened?
We were sitting, it was Dermot Keating actually phoned me. We were sitting in juries. We used to get up like, Ryan, you don't sleep when this is going on.
I can only imagine.
You just lie in bed every night.
Yeah.
You're just waiting for
demented.
Dawn. We were waiting for dawn.
Yeah.
You're waiting for light to come so that you can start again.
I hear you.
And so we were up maybe really early, sitting in juries. Next thing, phone call came through. Dermot Keating, believe it or not, he's been found in Hounslow, just outside Hounslow. He couldn't be arrested or anything like that. He had done absolutely nothing wrong. So Dermot said, look, there's two police. There's a police car gone out there. They're talking to him. Get out there as quickly as you can.
So what, you hop in a cab or...?
He said his advice was get on the tube. When you get to such and tube station, get off the tube, get a cab and get there quick.
So what happened when you get out of the cab at the... You find the spot in the park?
Yeah, Silverhall Park. You'll never forget that.
What did you see when you got there?
And what we saw was Ronan in the same red and blue anorak that he had worn weeks earlier going out the front door. And he was fairly battered. No, he looked fairly dishevelled.
Yeah.
And I think he was, you know, we had been told that he was not on his medication for a number of weeks. And they said this would have
an
effect on him, an impact. So I think he was nearly in a daze. But anyway, he broke down. Completely broke down, and I think we broke down as well, Ryan, to be honest with you. And it was just, I think the two police officers, lovely guys, they're two Scottish police officers working in London. They just stood back and said, this is a special moment. This doesn't happen in London a lot, you know.
What a story.
I think we plucked them from the abyss.
You did. You got them.
Yeah. We got him, and that was the attitude that we had going. We said, we're going to go in there, we're going to get him, and we're going to, as we said, bring him home, and that's where the title of the book came
from. Like a war zone. We're going to get him back. Yeah,
that's exactly
the way we were in a war zone.
Yeah, as I said, I tried to reflect that in the last chapter of the book.
Yeah.
I said, we were really going to war. We were going to war against the system, against all the negative attitudes that we were going to meet, against the bureaucracy and the red tape, and we were going to go in there and we were going to get him and get him out.
God, what a punch to the air. I'm so happy, because you're right.
Yeah.
You were battling stigma.
Yeah.
You were battling homelessness.
Yeah.
You're battling all the issues that we'd hoped would be alleviated 10 years later.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still talking, man, the rest.
We had no divine right to find him. We had no divine right.
I'm thinking of the people we pass in London, you know, or New York, with the Irish accent.
Yeah. Yeah,
troubled.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're somebody's brother, aren't they?
And there's a story in the book where we were in Hyde Park, where we met maybe 15 or 20 homeless Irish guys, or Irish people. And what we saw in London was fairly tough to take, you know, because we weren't there sightseeing or anything
like this.
We were on a mission, you know.
You've written a book about this, and it's called Bring Him Home,
yeah.
which we think of Colin Wilkinson and that gorgeous song,
yeah.
The Search for Ronan. And you're going to donate all the proceeds to a charity that yeah. just did this. Tell us.
Yeah, well, I think the real heroes in all of this in our society today are organisations like the MacFerrie Trust in Dublin and Cork Penny Dinners in Cork.
And that's Katrina Toomey, is it?
Katrina Toomey. So as a family, all our family decided to kind of, we consented, Ronan consented to do this book. My brothers, sisters, immediate family of everybody consented to do this book, and we all agreed that we would donate the proceeds of this back to Cork Penny Dinners. We would give something back for the help, the assistance, and the good fortune that we had in finding Ronan.
It's a very dignified approach to it all, and it's so important that you're talking about Ronan's story, I think. Again, back to the mental health thing and the removal of stigma. Yeah. You know, sadly, your father passed away, and I'm sorry to hear that.
He did,
but he
was a great man, Ryan, and he was a proud man. And
did he get to, he obviously got to, you know, meet up with Ronan.
Oh, yeah, sure. Ronan stayed with, my dad only passed away in 2011.
Yes.
And Ronan had been lived with my dad right up to the time.
It's lovely that he was. I mean, look, all these horrible stories of missing people.
Yeah.
All of them. I think this is possibly the first time I've ever interviewed somebody who went missing for so long, and who was unwell, and to come back like this. I mean, there's just something joyful in the sadness.
Yeah, yeah.
And that'd be fair to say.
It's, as I said, Ryan, it's an Irish story. It's a true story.
That's brilliant.
And it's an Irish story and a true story with a happy ending.
Well, this is the truth. And Waterstones in Cork, you can buy the book, and Hodges Figgis in Dublin from the end of November.
November. Thanks to two particular people as well. Kim Arnold, who was a freelance editor, who was great help to me. She's based in Kerry. Great lady.
Well done, Kim.
That's nearly another story how I met Kim.
Yeah, okay.
The other, Orla Kelly, the publisher, who really, my publisher, who really got stuck into this and really pushed it, and she's been great as well.
It's a great story, and hats off to Ciarán, says a text, on writing the story, shining a light on mental health and the heartache of a missing person case. To write a book on such a painful time and for the benefit of others is a true act of humanity. Best wishes to you, Ciarán, from all your colleagues in Westboro, which is the accountancy firm you work in.
That's right.
They're obviously all thinking of you today. Yeah. Ciarán, congratulations. It's funny because I showed you this before you came on the air, the holly bough. Do you know this?
I buy this every year, and my kids say, Dad, oh my God, Dad's after buying the holly bough.
It's that time of the year, bought it, and that's lovely. And the echo, of course, is so important to your story.
Absolutely.
So it's a bizarre symmetry, but it works nicely. Ciarán, to you and your family, thank you so much for coming to see us today. Appreciate you telling your story, and we're happy to tell people to pick that book up if they want to hear the story or read the story. Bring Him Home, The Search for Ronan by Ciarán Baxter. Nice to talk to you, and good luck with everything you do.
Thank you, Ryan.
It's 9:26 this Wednesday morning. I'm joined now by Jackie Donoghue. Good morning, Jackie, and thanks for coming in to see us this morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You have a fierce bag of notes there, and don't be worrying about those for the moment, because you're here for, I suppose you're here for difficult reasons. You had the awful tragedy of June 2015 when you lost your daughter, Ashley, and your niece, Olivia, from the fourth floor balcony of that rented apartment in Berkeley in California.
Mm-hmm.
It is a day that is etched in the minds of most people listening this morning, because we listened to the reports coming from the States and the harrowing news as they came in, and everyone thought for a moment that your daughter was our daughter and your family was our family, because that's what it felt like from away across the ocean. And yet it couldn't be anything like that, because obviously this is your family we're talking about. How have you been since, Jackie?
Well, if you ask me how I am, I'd say I'm fine.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if my husband was here today, the thing he would probably say, I'm grand.
Yeah.
So that's probably our answer. Fine and grand. Depends on the day.
And are they real thought out answers, or are they just words to get you through
the
a
words,
day?
Pretty much. And I think if you talk to most people like that, they'll say, oh, I'm fine, or I'm grand.
What happened that night? Can I ask you about that night, and by getting a phone call, just to put it all in context, because you've been doing extraordinary work about safety and buildings and so forth. But I suppose if we could go back to what happened and the phone call you got that time, you were at home.
Yeah, well, I think really about that night, I mean, going back, it's just, you know, I'm Ashley's mother and sure. Olivia's aunt, and they were killed when they fell off a balcony. The balcony collapsed back in June in 2015. I mean, they stepped out in a balcony in Berkeley. I mean, how many people, like, would tell their kids, you know, don't drink and drive, don't text, don't do this, text me when you get there. I know Ashley that night, she did text me to say she was arrived at the party, and it was a Monday night, it was for their friends. But in a million years, I don't think any parent would ever say, you know, don't step out in a balcony in the United States of America, because it could be the last step you'll take. And I don't think many people who's listening today even think every time they step out on a balcony in United States of America, it could be the last step they'll take. Because if you look at it, a lot of these balconies, well, that particular one was put 50 feet up in the air, cantilevered, no tiebacks to the building. It was made of wood, left out in the rain for 7 months plus, and then covered in stucco. So would you walk out on that balcony?
I wouldn't.
If you knew that particular company who'd actually built the balcony or built the apartment building had actually been sued many, many times beforehand.
Yeah.
And had paid out over $26 million for the same kind of thing, for water intrusion. I mean, I don't think any kid or any adult or anyone would walk out in a balcony if they knew that. So, I mean, these kids were in the, they were, you know, at a 21st, they were doomed. They were all 21. They were doing what they should be doing. So, I mean, it's just a horrible night. And going forward, obviously, we've all seen the papers with Berkeley and the families. I mean, and many people like send their kids away on a J1 from here.
Countless children.
And they don't think it'll be the last time that they'll see their kids.
Oh, yeah.
But what I would like to kind of hit on more would be even the support from the Irish government and the pastoral centre and everything. Because I think a lot of people in Ireland don't realise they send their kids away on a J1. If anything happens, it's the Irish consulate who does help them.
Can I mention the names of the other people involved on the basis that their families are probably listening this morning, and I don't want to upset anyone by saying that you lost, as I say, Ashley and Olivia Burke, but also the lives of Emer Walsh and Lorcan Miller and Nicolai Schuster and Owen Culligan, all celebrating the 21st of Aoife, who was seriously injured in the fall. I always like, when I'm talking to somebody, Jackie, to talk to them about, in this case, Ashley, and what kind of a girl she was and what kind of a daughter she was.
She was a wonderful daughter. Both her and my niece Olivia, they were best friends, because her name is Olivia Burke, obviously, my niece who passed away that night as well. And she was a type of kid that everyone looked up to.
A leader,
definitely. Always happy, involved, always included other people. And that has always been my motivation, because she would definitely say, "Mom, get them, don't let them away with it. And don't let anyone else go through what you guys are going through."
What was she studying? She was heading into her fifth
year. She was actually studying biology at Sonoma State. She was also interning at the coroner's office, that's in the sheriff's department. The day she passed, she actually had helped with 3 autopsies, and then came home and told her dad all about it, then went to her part-time job. She had a part-time job in a sushi place. Then she left because she was going down to the party for Aoife, because obviously with her and Olivia, they were so close back and forth all the time. Mm-hmm. And Olivia, it was Aoife's 21st, and she'd known Aoife for many, many years. Mm. She was up in Canada a year before with all the girls. So she was just one of these kids who was the life and soul. I mean, it's just, it's a big part of our life is missing and will always be missing. And it, when I look at like Ashley and I look at Olivia, both of them together, it's a huge loss for us.
You went to the States in what year?
We went in 89, and Ashley was born actually in May 28th. So she had just turned 22, where a lot of the other students who passed and that were turning 22 later that, you know, during the summer.
And had up until this point, had America been good to you from?
Oh, America's fine for us. I mean, we were fine in America. We were working away and, you know, you think your life is going to be fine and you're back and forth to Ireland and your kids are back and forth to Ireland and your life is going fine and this happens. So you really don't know with life, what life has in store for you.
And I think you were the only parent there that night. Is that right? You got to the scene.
Yeah. Myself and my husband were there and our other daughter, Amanda. And I mean, we knew obviously our own Ashley and Olivia had passed and then Emer. And we were trying to find out who the other kids were as well. And I mean, obviously you'd like someone to help your kid if you were the only mother there as well, to help the kids that were there. And but as I said, then like, the pastoral centre, I mean, the Father Brendan, who actually got this award a couple of years ago, he actually was there as well that night, and the Irish consulate. I mean, I don't think people realise how great the Irish government and what they did.
And the diplomatic service.
And the diplomatic service there for all the injured, for everyone.
Good.
Just unreal. And also, if you look at the pastoral centre, I mean, the support they gave to those kids, and not only the students who were injured or the families who had lost a child or children were injured, but also all the friends of all those kids.
Traumatised.
They were totally traumatised. Mm-hmm. And you look at the Irish Pastoral Centre and you look at Father Brendan, you look at Phil Grant, they were all on the ground at that time. And just amazing, the support that they actually gave to, and then also the Irish community, obviously, as well, over in the States.
What did they do for you, for your heart?
For me, it was just an amazing to see. For us, like, we lived in the States, so it was a little bit different. And obviously, with my niece as well, we had a service in where we live in St. Joseph's. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, with all the Irish consulate, the mayors, I mean, Anne Anderson, who was the ambassador at the time, just the outpour, I think, of support was unreal. And then, like, we came back here then, obviously, after, you know, for the other funerals, for the other kids. And just we went down, we seen a lot of the students as well who were in the hospital and who... And the support there was just amazing. Still, you see the pastoral centre going down. You'd see Phil Grant's, you know, the consulate office as well.
Still present.
Still involved with them all the time. And I can honestly say for me, even for the past, you know, 4 years with what I've been doing with changing the laws and that in California, they have been behind me 100% of the way.
Does this horrible disaster, Jackie, feel like it happened yesterday still?
It will never go away.
Does it feel as
it feels as like it's yesterday? Yeah, it could be yesterday.
That intensity. I mean,
the intensity is definitely there, and I mean, when you lose a child, I don't think you just don't expect your children to die before you.
It's the great unimaginable.
It's just unreal. It really, really is, and it's something you will never get over. You try and get through, and you try and live. I mean, you've another child or other children. You exist and you try and find the new normal.
Have you found the new normal?
I don't think we ever will. But I mean, we're just existing. And I think you'll go through your life thinking when you lose a child, you really lose your past, part of your past, your present and your future. Because everything you have kind of looked forward to and all, it's gone. It really, really is. And it changes people's lives. I mean, we were very fortunate, as I said, for all the support from the Irish people. Mm-hmm. Even, as I said, for myself going to Sacramento to change the laws, the legislation and that. I mean, the support from Phil Grant, the support from, he was the consul, sure, or general at the time in San Francisco. His assistant or vice consul at the time was Kevin Burns. Then Colm came in and, you know, Father Brendan. Now you have the new consul over there, who is Robert O'Driscoll. Just amazing.
And tomorrow you're going to be presented with an award by Michael D. Higgins, President of Ireland,
mm-hmm,
which is under the Presidential Distinguished Service Awards. How do you feel about that?
It's bittersweet.
It really
is. And I'm very humble. I'm very shocked to be actually receiving that award. But for me, I'm really accepting this award on really behalf of the six souls who passed that night.
You'll be thinking about them every step of the way.
I think about them all the time.
Do you?
I mean, every time I go to Sacramento, I have their pictures in front of me. I mean, I look at it. I mean, Olivia, my niece, forever 21. I look at Emer, forever 21. Owen, forever 21. Nikolai, forever 21. Lorcan, forever 21. And then my darling daughter, Ashley, would be forever 22.
Forever 22.
So
they'll be with
they'll
you.
They'll be always. And as I said, there's been so much support. I mean, you look at, the president was out before. He came out and he thanked all the first responders out there. They planted trees. Mm. They've, for me, even letters coming from the Irish government, or you have even the ambassador writing letters, mm-hmm, as well. The support is definitely there.
Let me ask you a little bit, if I can, Jackie, about what just, I need to share with people at home how extraordinary you've been in terms of what you've done in regarding building regulations, these balconies, these rogue builders, the cowboys. You went on a mission, and you said at the beginning of our chat here this morning that Ashley would have said, you go get them.
100%.
And you went to get them, didn't you? Can you give me a sense of what you've done? I mean, you've gone to politicians, you've gone to the highest positions to change the law. You deserve this moment, but I really want people to get a sense of what you've done. Can you tell us what you've changed?
Well, I think for me, it's just never give up. I mean, the first bill that was out there was, won't matter numbers, SB4. 65 and that. And that changed some of the codes and that. And then there was a part of it that was for reporting. So with the balcony, mm-hmm, which was built by this particular construction company,
yeah,
who had paid out 23 plus million a couple of years beforehand for the same thing, water intrusion.
Just to explain that, they had paid out over 23 million euro in construction defect settlements.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That were never reported to the state.
That's
license
what I was going to say.
Remarkable.
The contractor's licensing board is someone who oversees California.
Yes.
And the bottom line is they receive probably, I'm going to say 15,000 roughly,
yeah,
consumer complaints a year. But they're only usually for single family homes. They wouldn't be for the multi big construction industries,
sure,
because anything with them, they settle and the insurance company pays it and nobody knows about it. So for me, it was, well, why does California even have a contractor's licensing board? Is it only for going after the little people like me? If I say built a fence too near the road on my property or something, they'll come and, you know, tell me to take it down and fine me, blah, blah, blah. But are they're not going to go after a big company like that, because they don't know what they've paid out, because the insurance will pay it and move on. So that part of the bill was scratched. It was sent off for a study. And usually when something is sent off for a study, it's bye-bye, never to be seen again.
Yes.
So I actually then start contacting the contractor's licensing board, and I start sending them everything and so much research anyway, meeting with them and asking them questions. And I was blown away with the answers I was getting, because I wasn't satisfied. So then the contractor's licensing board had, they had to vote to see would this go back for legislation the following year. And we'll say One person actually on the committee voted for not to go back. Big mistake. So for me, red flag, go home all mad about it. And it did go back for legislation.
Sure.
But that particular person owned the company. And that company had paid out about over $1 million for water intrusion, probably about a year before.
This is the water intrusion you talked about
yes.
earlier, that was
yes.
the balcony.
And totally different, but nobody knew about it.
No.
And this person was on the contractor's licensing board. And for me, that's a conflict of interest.
Wouldn't you think?
So I kept it in my pocket. And then like when it was going through for the governor to sign, I met with the governor's office and I let them know I might be a grieving mother. But there's something fishy going on if they have somebody on this board who's actually voting no, doesn't want it to go back, and they've already paid out for a company. It's a conflict of interest and they shouldn't be on that board.
You exposed it.
So I totally exposed that. But for me, it's like every time I'd go to Sacramento, every committee, I'd go to who was on the committee,
yeah.
how much they received from whoever supported them. Were they Republican? Were they Democrats? Whatever.
Were you doing this all on your own?
Yeah. This was a nighttime. Every night I'd okay. spend hours on it. And I usually, whatever I talk about was directed at whoever was on that committee.
Mm.
So a lot of people that probably heard me speak were probably thinking that lady's crazy, but it was directed to whoever and they would know that I knew whatever about them at the time. But I mean, that was very important to me. And it shows, I think when you're going there and you, it's a side and it's putting a face. It's not just these committees, they're reading through stuff and signing off yes, no, whatever.
You were determined, as I understand it, Jackie, to humanize the legislation, to put a face and to put mm-hmm. breathe life into these numbers and words that were meaningless mm-hmm. and kind of corrupt by the sounds of things.
It is.
And when you testified to the California State Senate hearing in 2016, you said the most striking things that really would, in terms of humanizing it, can I read some of the words
yeah,
you
fine.
Said? I don't want to
no, it's fine.
Ask you to do it because it wouldn't be fair, but you talked about Ashley and you said she should be here today
mm-hmm.
and she should have graduated on May 24th and her birthday, she would have been 23, but she's not here. She'll be forever, like you said a minute ago, 22. She'll never get married. Her father will never walk her up the aisle and her cousin Olivia will never be her bridesmaid. And I would tell you one thing you said. Her father carried her up the aisle. And he carried her coffin up the aisle.
Well, what you have to do, it hurts for me as a mother and an aunt and a friend and for all these that are parents, but you have to get through to these people, whatever it takes. And if it means having to, you know, say things like that, you do have to see the human side.
Did you get
what we're going through?
Did you get the results you wanted?
Yes, people, because what happens is a lot of people are shocked by it and they have kids and they then start thinking about if that was, because I always tell them, if that was your child, how would you feel?
Precisely.
Exactly, how would yeah. you feel? So I think that's a big part of it. So that was one of the bills anyway. Just being another couple, one was for, I'm used to results and to have to keep on going back and back and be patient.
Yeah.
Another one went through then the same time back in 2018 for the apartment buildings for inspections. And that was another thing that drove me nuts, because inspections, you had someone who anyone could go out. I could become an inspector tomorrow where I know nothing about construction.
Really?
Take the test and pass if I was good at test taker. But now they want license. So that was changed for the apartments. Then the condos weren't included in that. So
Back again. Okay.
So that the condos only went through there in this September.
Which means that the legislation now is watertight.
No. It's not watertight, because I don't think it'll ever be watertight. The construction industry, obviously, they didn't want the reporting of secret settlements. Obviously, the construction industry didn't want to have inspections done on these balconies.
But you've got that changed.
But there's still inspections. they're not in hotels. So anyone who goes to a hotel, start looking at the hotels and all these balconies. They can go down.
You're from Talla originally.
I am.
And you moved in 89, like so many other Irish people, mm-hmm. for a better life in America.
We went for 2 years and we're still there.
You're still there. And I can hear your Dublin coming out and I can hear your American weaved, because that's your story. It's a weaving of the two.
It's probably a weaving of the two.
It sure is. Mm-hmm. Are you a lawyer?
No.
No. Are you a teacher?
No.
Are you a politician?
No.
So where did this person come from, who's a combination of all of these things? Because you're a fighter.
I've always been a fighter. I actually, for over 20 years, I was involved with educational sales. So I was vice president of different colleges, and I turned failing colleges around. So I was heavily involved in education. But I think I've always been that person who wants to do the right thing, no matter what it takes. And that was something I really instilled into both my girls.
You've had, and by the way, Amanda was with us, and she was the Rosa Tralee candidate.
San Francisco, yeah.
Yeah. And I hope life has been good to her.
It's great. She's actually in Ireland. She's studying for her PhD now in UCD.
Yeah, she's across the road.
Across the road. Good on and her. She loves it. She actually, she just got back from CERN. That's another thing I'm looking at. When I see CERN, Ireland's not part of CERN.
So you
and I'm
get
thinking,
that going on.
That needs to go.
I feel another fight coming on, Jackie, and I'd rather not be involved. I'd rather not work in CERN if you're coming at me, because that's going to change everything.
I think the Irish government just probably forgot to put the check in the mail. Maybe it got lost.
You know, before we came on air, you were saying briefly that, you know, you've had loss in your life, you know, your parents, and you mentioned a brother But Ashley is where the difficulty in terms of forging ahead lies. How hopeful are you about the future and Ashley's memory and legacy?
Well, I think that for me is very important, is the six kids' legacy. And that was something I remember when Anne Anderson was out, when I met her actually, when the president came out that October in 2015. And she was the one who even said, you know, maybe you should look at getting bills passed, because at that stage I had seen some stuff that wasn't right. And that's when I start getting involved more. And, you know, you always need somebody watching things.
A text says, I'm feeling very low at the moment. I'm self-employed. Business is about to close up and I'm up to my eyes in debt and in taxes and in mortgage. But I still have my two beautiful children. And God bless that lady. Her chat has inspired me to get up and keep going.
Well, you know what? You have to do the right thing, because one person, I really do believe, can make a difference. And no matter what it is, you know, if you believe in something, you just keep going and do the right thing. And I think as Irish people, I mean, they do, and they do help you, and you'd be surprised the amount of support you can get if you ask for it.
Jackie Donoghue, it's been a pleasure to meet you. I wish it wasn't under these circumstances, and I wish you all the very best in life with your family. I hope you have a dignified evening tomorrow with the President at Ourson Lutheran, and that Ashley and the other young people's lives are remembered appropriately, and that they're present with you, not only then, but into the future. So mind yourself, please, and I hope you're well-minded.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Jackie Donoghue, you're joining us live in the studio this morning. Back shortly. Robbie Williams fans will be very pleased to hear that he's brought out a new Christmas album. It's got covers and original songs with some very special guest appearances. It comes in vinyl and CD, and you can download it wherever you get your music. And some people even get a Robbie Williams The Christmas Present Christmas card, complete with written message and sound message like this. Isn't that gorgeous? We'll put visual representations of this on Instagram a little later on. The album, as I say, is called The Christmas Present, and Robbie Williams is on the line to talk about it and the great year he's had. Robbie Williams, good morning. How are you doing?
Do you know what? If I was rating my day, it would be an 8.5 out of 10. Where do you rate your day?
I would be heading towards an 8 for starters and looking forward to a 9.
How fortunate to be in the high 8. And heading towards 10s. Good for us.
It's likewise. I mean, the last time we met, you did Joe Dolan a great service on the TV show. Is that right?
Yeah, and then I did Good Looking Woman on at the Aviva, and the place went off.
Great.
It's a proper moment that I'll never forget.
That's great. We really enjoyed that because you kind of embraced it, and that crowd just went, yes. And then your Aviva crowd went, yeah, he's kind of one of ours. Do you feel like an adopted son sometimes when you come to Ireland?
Do you know what? I've always, even before coming to Ireland, grown up feeling Irish in many ways. You know, I've always felt as though a part of my heart's over there. You know, my family are from Kilkenny.
Mm-hmm.
And, a part of me will always be Irish.
I want to talk to you a bit about Christmas because two things. One, you've got an album called The Christmas Present, which we will be talking about in a moment. But you said I don't know at what point, you said a couple of years ago, you said, my wife loves Christmas and I didn't used to. And it was that bit that I was curious about, the fact that you didn't used to. What happened?
Have you ever fallen out of love with Christmas?
Maybe for about 2 years when I was a grumpy, student-y type.
Yeah, well, I had to give up drinking 19 years ago. I haven't had a drink for 19 years. And a lot of Christmas, for me, is wrapped up with euphoric recall of incredible moments in the pub with my friends.
Mm.
And then, you know, it's a case of stop drinking or die. And then when you're given that, you're like, okay, well, I don't want to die. I better stop drinking. And then you're faced with a few Christmases where you're like, what do you do now? You know, I don't get it. I don't know how I'm supposed to, function as a person at Christmas if I'm not drunk. So I had those moments, about, 4 or 5 years of that. Then I met my wife, and she's like the spirit of Christmas. You know, she goes overboard, but you can't help swinging into, you know, the swing of things with her. Our place is like, I don't know, where's the equivalent of Blackpool Illuminations in Ireland?
Well, I'd say you could go with Grafton Street is pretty spectacular, pretty beautiful.
Well, you know, our place is like Grafton Street at Christmas. And, you know, it's lovely. But like a lot of me is from Stoke-on-Trent too. So all I think about is the electricity bill. But ever since the wife's arrived, every Christmas comes and goes. And like Boxing Day, without fail, we'll turn to each other and say, that's been the best Christmas ever, every year. And now with the kids, it's even more special.
Yeah, I remember when you came on shortly after, one of the times you appeared on the Late Late Show, was shortly after Teddy was born. And I think we had a brief chat off air about the beauty of being dads of daughters. And you've had two more since then. But what has that done to you, being a dad, whatever about Christmas, but just how much fun are you having as a dad?
Well, I'm finding it I think the gamers call it Easter eggs. Like these computer games get left with these Easter egg presents that you find as you achieve more levels, and they're sort of like surprises.
Yes.
And I feel that that's the same way with kids. You know, you don't know, but the universe leaves you loads of blanks, and you kind of only know that you've filled them in once you have children. And you're like, oh my God, because I nearly didn't have kids, nearly didn't want kids. But now I'm like, I completely get it. It's the full human experience, and I'm totally and utterly in love. And I managed to get home last night, and bless her, Teddy the eldest, I wasn't happy that she got it, but she got like a bit of a fever. And I was just so great to be able to plonk her in bed next to me and me just stroke her face and tell her everything's going to be all right and give her some love. You know, it was a beautiful moment. That happened last night. Mm. And those beautiful moments happen all of the time. I love being a dad. And, the universe just beams back at you. And it's really special.
Agreed on everything you've said. It's a beautiful thing. And there's a couple of projects that you got involved in that I don't know, would you have done them if you didn't have your gorgeous kids looking up at you? I mean, a guest of ours on this programme not too long ago, before she died, Judith Kerr, who wrote The Tiger That Came to Tea, sees you singing the song, Hey Tiger, for that. I mean, that's kind of exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, and the reason I'm doing that is many, the people that wrote the song are heroes of mine. But it's the first book that I actually read to Ted over and over and over again. And I got such a kick when she started learning how to speak. And then I'd leave out the last word of each sentence and she'd fill in the words that were supposed to be there. And, you know, it's just another one of those fatherly moments where you're just, you know, the world is good. So it's a pleasure to get involved.
And the musical adaptation of The Boy in the Dress, a great, very popular book in this country, David Walliams, you co-wrote the music with Guy Chambers, I understand. And again, another gorgeous thing for the kids to enjoy with you and getting into that lovely world.
Yeah, also David's a really good mate of mine. I love him to bits. So to be asked to do that is a great opportunity. And to actually pull it off as well, we had to do like 24 songs in 2 weeks.
Really?
You know, I've never done that before, but we managed to do it. Show hasn't been out yet, but it's coming out soon, and we'll see if the general public like the songs. I hope so.
And with the Christmas album, with the Christmas present, you've done covers on it, right? Like Merry Christmas, Everybody, and the likes. And are these songs, or Christmas Baby, Please Come Home, would you have chosen them yourself, Robbie, as sort of songs you loved growing up, or did somebody say, we'd love you to do these ones?
No, these are my favourite Christmas songs, but they're actually just a tool to get people to listen to the ones that I've written myself.
What ones now do you want us to listen to? What should we be playing here?
The single, he cynically said. God. The single, A Time for Change.
I should have guessed Time for Change, but yeah. You've also got guest appearances on the album. Are you allowed to tell us who those guests are?
Yeah, Liam Gallagher's doing a song with me. Brian Adams, Rod Stewart.
Great.
Jamie Cullum.
Oh, it's
my
quite...
dad. People are telling me he's doing a duet with me right now as I'm walking around this room. But who's on the album?
Yeah, who's on my album that I made? I'm dying to know. You joined Hugh Jackman on stage recently. He was on the show with us as well, and we're massive fans of The Greatest Showman, and the title could be one of your own autobiographies. But is he somebody you kind of connected with?
Yeah. I've got like a huge man crush on Hugh. And, you know, to top it off, I know him and I can email him and talk to him, you know, sort of like a stalker. he's just everything that you would imagine him to be. He's just like the perfect man.
Yes.
And I love him to bits. And I went and sang with him at the O2 over here in London. And I just, you know, I watched his first four numbers and I think I was the fifth song of the set that evening. And I was just like watching it slack-jawed, like, oh my God, you can do all of that and you can do all of this too.
Yes.
He's incredible.
Yeah, he's
phenomenal.
I was watching it during the year in X Factor, and it was a program. I was wondering, was that something you had always wanted to get into? And then I understand that you really, really enjoyed that experience, and it kind of has you thinking about maybe getting into that side of the world, TV-wise, America-wise. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm coming for your job.
Yes, start big and work your way down.
I'm going to be doing TV next year. Not much I can tell you about it right now, because obviously when it's about to happen, I want it to have the most impact that it can. But I'm thinking about this certain project for quite a long time. But as you know, it takes quite a long time to get these sort of things up and running. And when I have more information, I'll tell you more about it. But I've always been a TV presenter. That's what I am. You know, like when you see a TV presenter or an actor that all of a sudden sings and you go, oh, they can hold a tune. Good for them. That's me.
That's old school.
So I'm just heading back to what I actually am, you know, TV presenter, actor.
And that's okay. So you have a project kind of in the pipeline that you're going to come back and tell us about the next time. So that's fine. That sounds exciting.
Absolutely.
Two of your own personal commandments, thou shalt not wed and thou shalt not kids, have been well and truly broken. Are they the best commandments you've ever broken?
Absolutely. I'm 13 years into a relationship with my wife. But I've managed it. I didn't think I would be able to.
Yeah.
And it's just because the power of her and her personality, how much I love her, how much I trust her, how much I value her. And yeah, I'm a lucky man.
Did you see Bohemian Rhapsody? Did you see Rocket Man?
I haven't seen Rocket Man yet.
It's great.
But I will do. And I saw Bohemian Rhapsody. I thought it was a great film.
And could you see yourself in that mode at some stage?
What, being somebody or somebody being me?
Somebody being you. Now, the problem with you is you probably want to play yourself, which I understand, but...
I'm too old to play me. I've already been told that.
But do you fancy the idea of it, the Robbie Williams sort of biopic?
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what's occurring when it occurs.
And what's the plan then in 2020? It's coming around the corner now. Are you going to do any more touring? Are you back? You know, you're doing a bit of an Elvis stint in Vegas, so you're following in great footsteps there. I believe that's going very well. What's the plan?
I'm always doing bits and bobs. I've got a residency in Vegas, like you say. I do festivals. I do the odd gig here and there. And then I go and do the world tour sort of every 3 years. But I've got a big anniversary coming up for myself. Pretty soon, you know, it's 25 years as a solo artist coming up.
Yeah.
And I shall be exploiting that.
It's the honesty I love because, you know, a less cynical person or a more cynical person wouldn't qualify it the way you do. The album's called The Christmas Present. Happy Christmas, Robbie.
Thanks, mate. Happy Christmas to yourself. It's always good to speak to you.
Really nice to see you. I look forward to seeing you next time you're in Ireland. That's Robbie Williams joining us.
Then.
Take it easy. Thank you so much. Joining us to talk about his new album, The Christmas Present, which, as he says, is a mix'em gather'em of the great and the good, and concluding some of his own brand new music, which I think you're going to love. And nice. OK, we'll leave that there for now. The text number is always 51551.